From time to time, there are salespeople that come to my door, and I've responded to them in different ways. So there are people that have come to my door, and I am not interested at all in what they have to offer me. And I try to be polite, but I'm trying to get very quickly into their conversation and say, I'm not interested. And sometimes that's hard because once they start their spiel, they don't take a breath. You have to try to find their breath and not interrupt them. But there are other times that I've listened to somebody, didn't know what they were offering, decided I'm going to listen, hear them out. And I've been persuaded somewhat that what they have to offer could be helpful. But in those moments, I'm not very quick to jump in still. I don't want to actually make that rash decision right then. I want to think about it a little bit more, which they don't want because they know that there are people like me who what happens when they leave is I forget about what they just offered. And so they try to pressure you into making that decision because it's not going to be available when they leave. And I usually am able to say, okay, well, that's fine, but I'm not ready to commit yet. When I have made a rash decision, when I have given in to the pressure, I nearly always regret it. So it's never a good experience in that moment. Then there's what happened this past week. Laura and I, we've been unhappy with a couple different things in our life recently. One is our internet speed, and the other is our cell phone bill. And so, you know, we've been looking into different things, trying to figure out, well, what should we try? What could be different? What do we want to do? And we looked into Spectrum, and lo and behold, a Spectrum salesman showed up on our doorstep this week. That was a completely different experience. He did not have to work very hard. We basically just asked him a few different questions. So, I mean, he must have been kind of shocked because I'm sure his experience had been what I usually do to salesmen. That's probably what he had seen up to that point. But we had already determined that we needed something. We'd already decided we wanted something, and he had what we wanted. So we were very amenable to his offer. And the reality is, I have had that same offer. You know, you walk into Sam's Club, you walk into a store, and somebody wants to give you an offer. I have been very quick to say, no, thank you. Thankfully, I'm usually ignorant of what I actually have. Like, I don't know if we have AT&T or Spectrum, so I can just say, I don't know, and I'm not interested. But this time was different. The difference was I really wanted what the person was selling. That makes the difference. If you don't want what the person has, you're not receptive to what they're offering you. If you already want what the person has, you're very receptive to what they're offer. So that's what makes the difference. Our disposition, our attitude towards what's being given to us. Jesus is going to explain why people respond differently to the good news when it's shared. Why his experience, as he shared the good news with people around him, why people have responded differently. And it has very much to do with the condition of our heart, as we're going to see. So if you look over at Matthew 13, the very beginning of the chapter, we'll look at this illustration that he gives, first of all, in Matthew 13. Starting in verse 1. It says, that same day Jesus went out of the house and sat beside the sea, and great crowds gathered about him, so that he got into a boat and sat down, and the whole crowd stood on the beach. And he told them many things in parables, saying, a sower went out to sow, and as he sowed, some seeds fell along the path, and the birds came and devoured them. Other seeds fell on rocky ground, where they did not have much soil, and immediately they sprang up, since they had no depth of soil, but when the sun rose, they were scorched. And since they had no root, they withered away. Other seeds fell among thorns, and the thorns grew up and choked them. Other seeds fell on good soil and produced grain, some 100-fold, some 60, some 30. He who has ears, let him hear. So these first two verses here, they set up the rest of the chapter. Jesus is going to tell a number of different parables. And the situation is Jesus leaves the house where this confrontation with the Pharisees occurred, where his family had just tried to interrupt him. He leaves that house and he goes out to the beach. And you could think that Jesus is trying to get away. There's this crowd that's gathering around him, but he's actually providing an opportunity to teach them. And he sits down That's the posture of a person, a rabbi or a teacher, before they teach. And the crowd gets it. So they crowd in, but there's too many of them. And so Jesus needs a way to amplify his voice. He needs to set up a sound system. And that's what he does by getting in the boat. He gets in the boat, and that allows him to amplify his voice. Michael Wilkins pointed out that if the traditional site is right for where this took place around the Sea of Galilee, then it took place in a little cove. And the way that the land sloped down, it created a natural amphitheater. And what scientists that have looked at the area, they studied it, they found that you could hear a person very clearly up to 100 meters away. So roughly the size or the length between one end zone from another on a football field. You could hear that person. So Jesus did that in order to teach. And there he is in the boat. The crowd gathers right up to the water's edge. And he teaches them, but he doesn't teach them the way that he teaches his disciples. He speaks in parables. We're going to look at why he does that next week. He gives an explanation. We're going to focus just on this first parable this week. But suffice it to say, a parable is one of those expressions, stories, sayings that has a surface meaning, but then there's a deeper meaning. And only certain people have access to that deeper meaning. Specifically his disciples here. There's a parable in the Old Testament that I think shows how you can get the surface meaning and miss the deeper meaning. Nathan went to David in 2 Samuel 12 with a story. He told him the story about two men, a rich man and a poor man. The rich man had many herds, many lambs. He had much herds and flocks. And then the poor man had one ewe lamb that was like a daughter to him. And Nathan tells a story about how this rich man, when a guest came, chose to take that poor man's lamb. Instead of all the lambs that he had to choose from, he took the poor man's lamb and killed it and sacrificed it, or gave it for his guest, rather. And David's a shepherd. David's around sheep all the time. When he hears that, thinking this is a true story, he kind of flies off the handle. He is outraged by it, and he says, that person should die. That rich man, he should die, and he's going to have to at least pay fourfold for what he's done. David understood the story. He understood the surface meaning of the story. But he didn't understand the deeper meaning until Nathan said, David, you are the man. There was a deeper meaning that he didn't understand. That's the way parables work. There's a surface meaning to them that's accessible to anyone. They get it. People can understand what's being said. And they react variously. But there's a deeper meaning, a deeper intention to those stories that's not obvious. So the first parable here in chapter 13, it's a farming story. We could call it a story. It's more like a scene from everyday life. And the people in Jesus' day, they would have understood what Jesus was saying because most of them had a small field, maybe more like a garden, that they would grow crops for themselves. Or they were day laborers who worked in somebody else's field. So farming and that practice was common. And so Jesus describes this common practice of planting wheat or barley. They had a sack that they would hold over them. They'd just take the seed and scatter it by hand. And in that process, some of the seed that's scattered, it falls on these four different soils, these four different types of ground. And some falls on a path alongside the field. Some on shallow ground that covers bedrock. Some fall on ground that contains weeds. And some fall on the good ground. So the seed that falls on the path, well, people have been walking all over the path. The seed's not going to penetrate that soil. It's just going to stay on the surface. And so it's easy pickings for birds. They come by and they pick it all up. They eat it up, devour it. The seeds on the bedrock, it looks at first like, hey, this is going to be promising. Because the bedrock is invisible. It's underneath the soil. And so the seed shoots up first. It gives these sprouts. But that bedrock keeps it from being able to grow any root system or any firm root system. And so then the summer months come, the summer heat comes, and these little shoots can't survive. So they wither away. They die. Then there's the seed that falls in with the weeds. And the two of them grow up together, but the weeds steal the nutrients from the wheat. And so that wheat ends up being just shoots of grass. It doesn't produce grain, doesn't produce any fruit. It doesn't have the nutrients to do that. And then finally, there's the seed that falls on the good soil. And the way that Matthew describes it, it's a dynamic way that he describes it. It's like we're watching this process from beginning to end. And he describes it as we're watching these stalks producing fruit. They're continually, throughout the time of from planting to harvest, they're producing this fruit. And so in the end, you have a harvest, and the farmer sees that some of those stalks that grow from an individual seed, some of those stalks, they produce 30 pieces of grain on the stalk. Some of them produce 60 pieces of grain. Some produce 100 pieces of grain on one stalk. I'm not an expert. I looked at it. It seemed kind of crazy. But I did read somewhere that barley typically, now I know this is our barley, but it typically is from 25 to 60 pieces of grain on a barley, just one stalk of barley. So what Jesus seems to be describing here is your normal range. But then in Genesis 26:12, God blessed Isaac's crop, and it grew a hundredfold, or it produced a hundredfold. So he gives the averages, you know, the low average, 30, the higher average, 60, and then something that's way above average, 100. Now, the thing we have to keep in mind in this analogy, Jesus is giving an illustration, is the goal of planting seeds. What's the farmer's goal in planting seeds? Just the plant itself? His goal is not the plant itself. His goal is the grain that it produces. The plant itself is not worthwhile. It's the grain. And so what this description shows is that there's three different types of ground that actually produce plants. But there's only one type of ground that actually produces what the farmer is after, which is the grain. So the only one that counts in the analogy is the one that actually produces grain. In our day, we think of things scientifically. So we see something growing, and we say, well, there's something living there. And so we're tempted to assume that there's at least something good happening in the case of the plant that grew up at first, but then it withered away, or the plant that grew up and didn't produce any fruit. We think that there's something to that. But first century farmers weren't thinking scientifically, or they weren't concerned about the plants. All that they were caring about was the grain. We need to keep that in mind. So a little later in chapter 13, Jesus explains his parable. If you look down at verse 18, he says, "Hear then the parable of the sower. When anyone hears the word of the kingdom and does not understand it, the evil one comes and snatches away what has been sown in his heart. This is what was sown along the path. As for what was sown on rocky ground, this is the one who hears the word and immediately receives it with joy. Yet he has no root in himself, but endures for a while. And when tribulation or persecution arises on account of the word, immediately he falls away. As for what was sown among thorns, this is the one who hears the word, but the cares of the world and the deceitfulness of riches choke the word, and it proves unfruitful. As for what was sown on good soil, this is the one who hears the word and understands it. He indeed bears fruit and yields in one case a hundredfold, in another 60, and in another 30. So Jesus gives here an interpretation of his parable, and he explains four responses to his message. They've been experiencing, as Jesus has shared the gospel, different responses, and Jesus is going to explain these four responses. And it's not as though there aren't more complex, more specific ways that people respond. But generally speaking, the responses to the gospel fall within these four categories. That doesn't mean there is one response for every person for all time. So listen to the example of a pastor friend of mine, Joe Trofimuk, in one of his sermons. He said this about himself. He said, "I think I was genuinely born again in 1993 when I was 26 years old. What always stands out to me is that I thought I was saved a lot longer than that. And I see myself in the parable of the sower. Thankfully, by God's grace, I believe in 1993, seed was sown on the good soil, but I think my earlier life was characterized by something, some of the other soil." He said, I would have been one of those people perhaps that would have said that I responded with joy when I heard the word, but the reality was I wasn't born again. It was a temporary response. So understand that each response to the gospel, a person can respond one way at one point in their life, and they can respond in a different way later on. What Jesus is talking about is not once for all time response, but he's talking about the responses that happen when you share the good news. How do people respond? Why do they respond the way that they do? And so the story mentions these seeds falling on different parts of or different types of ground. Well, in verses 18 through 23, spreading the seed corresponds to this message, hearing the message of the kingdom. That's the comparison. Verse 19 mentions something being sown in a person's heart, the word being sown in a person's heart. So the soil is compared to a person's heart, their inner person, their thinking, emotions, desires, all that goes into the inner person. The character of the inner person is seen in their response to the good news. So again, chapters 11 and 12, Jesus has been sharing the good news, and people have been responding to it differently. And the disciples could wonder, well, what's going on? I mean, this message should be received. I mean, this is great news. The kingdom's here. The king's here. This should be good news. And people are not responding that way. So Jesus explains, here's why people are not responding this way. The issue has to do with the person's heart. And so Jesus gives this good news, and just to summarize it, it's the message that he gives is that the kingdom of heaven has been brought near by him. So people should repent of their sin for the forgiveness of sin, and that in Jesus, they can be a part of the kingdom. By being his disciple, they can be a part of the kingdom. Now, this takes place, when Jesus is sharing this good news, it takes place before he's died and rose again. So there is the message is not as clear until after Jesus dies and rises again. We know that that message is that Jesus has come, that he is the rightful king, that we are in rebellion against him, and that we should turn from that. That we should trust in what he's done. He came, lived the life that we should live, died to pay the punishment for sinners like us, and then he rose again, and we should trust in that. And so as we hear that message, question is, how do people respond to that? How do we even respond to that message? So Jesus gives four responses here. What are those responses? The first one is rejection. First response is that the person rejects the message because they have no saving understanding of the good news. So the first soil, it's this hardened path. It's an unreceptive soil. Hard heart. It does not receive the seed. So the way Jesus says that, though, is a little bit intriguing because he says this is the person who does not understand. When we hear those words, we assume it's talking about comprehension. Now, any teacher or any parent understands there are levels of comprehension. So this is not saying that the person doesn't comprehend it at all. Note there's an experience of an individual named Walt Kaiser. I think it shows that a person can understand the meaning, even the logic of the good news, and still reject it. He was studying at a university, and he was listening to a lecture by a recently retired professor from Yale. And during one part of the lecture, he began to explain Romans 1 through 5. And listen to what Kaiser says. He says, with unusual eloquence and masterful exegesis, he walked through these chapters with a precise deftness, affirming that everyone in the class had sinned and therefore had come short of the glory of God. But for those who would believe in God's sacrifice of his son for their sins, they would not just be made righteous. No, they would be declared righteous by a God who justified sinners. And one of the students interrupts him. And this student asks the question, do I get the impression that the professor of this class believes this stuff? He's incredulous. Listen to how the professor responds. Who said anything about believing it? I'm just arguing that this is what Paul said. I'm sick and tired of hearing the younger scholars say, this is what this or that text means to me. I was trained under the old liberal theology. We learned what Paul said. We just don't happen to believe what Paul said. It's possible to understand the content of the gospel, to recognize what's being required of you, and yet at the same time, not to understand the truthfulness of it. That's what Jesus is getting at here by saying they don't understand. He's not saying they don't understand the words. He's saying they don't understand the truthfulness of the message. But he adds that the devil, represented by the birds, is also involved in this. So Satan here is called the evil one. He snatches the message away. It's sitting there lying on the surface because of the hardness. It's not received. It's not taken in. And because it lies there, birds have an easy way, or the devil then has an easy way of removing that message from them. It's not that the devil reaches into your mind and takes it away. That's not what the devil has to do in order to snatch away the good news. He can direct us to think about things in a certain way. So take the professor, the Yale professor, for example. He'd likely been convinced that certain things cannot be true. They just can't be true. That there are no unseen forces at work in our world. What you see is what you get. All that there is in the universe is what we observe with our senses, and everything that happens in the world happens and has always happened the way we observe it, which rules out things like resurrection. So it's not very hard for a person to have the good news snatched away from them by the encouragement that, look, these ideas that somebody could be risen from the dead, that's just a superstitious idea from ancient peoples. And just like that, the devil does snatch away the message from the person's thinking, encouraging their rejection, even ensuring their continued rejection. So the first response that you see here is that rejection, responding without a saving knowledge of the good news. The second response is apostasy. It means that you accept the good news at first, and then later you reject it. And so that happens because of a shallow understanding of the good news. The second soil was found on rocky ground. It wasn't that there were rocks that you could see. It was the bedrock that was just below the surface. It wasn't observable. So this is the person that hears the good news and responds excitedly. They respond emotionally even. It's not just a calm response. This is an enthusiastic response. They may even have demonstrated that response by an apparent changed life. If they first respond and they do a 180 and it looks like there's genuine repentance, the sprout shoots up. You can see life. But then comes the pressure, the persecution, the affliction. See, the world and the devil and even our own flesh is not going to just allow a person to listen to the good news and not apply some pressure. There's going to be pressure on our commitment to Christ because the world does not agree with Jesus' morality. The world does not agree that Jesus should come first. So sometimes, so take an example of that kind of pressure. It might be just an intellectual pressure, right? You're a student at a university, and you're sitting in a humanities class. And the professors, they're going section by section and showing how these beliefs in the Bible, they're silly if you really believe they happened. And that student, that is a convert, comes out that they believe that Jesus rose from the dead. Well, the students, they all affirm what the professor's been teaching. So they might apply pressure by mocking that person's medieval, unthoughtful way of looking at the world. Or they may then say, oh, you're a follower of Jesus. Well, what do you say about marriage? What do you say about gender? And that pressure may come by calling the person a bigot. And you're not up with the times. There will be pressure in our world when somebody makes a profession of faith, when they say that they are following Jesus. Now, the time constraints aren't spelled out. It just says for a while, for a time. We just know that the plant didn't make it to the harvest. The person didn't endure to the end. The pressure came at some point along the way. It doesn't specify whether it was early or whether it was late. And notice how the response to the pressure is the same as the response to the gospel. At the end of verse 20, he immediately receives the message. At the end of verse 21, he immediately falls away. And he does that, verse 21 says, because he has no root in himself. He could only endure for a little while because that message didn't really take root. Didn't have a foundational commitment to Christ. His belief was superficial. It doesn't look that way. People can even say, hey, there's an in-depth understanding. You look at a person and the way that they describe things, the way that they talk about themselves, it sounds legitimate, real, but it was superficial. They believed the facts, but they weren't actually committed to Christ. The problem, Jesus specifies, has to do with the person's heart. There was a defect in the heart that eventuated in apostasy. That's not the way it looked, though. Again, on the surface, it didn't look like there was any defect. It didn't look like there was any problem. So that's all we have to work with, what we see. And because that's all we have to work with, it's natural for someone to assume that we're all the same internally. Our hearts are all basically the same. And there's no real difference between people. And so from that standpoint, this person who believed at one time and then doesn't believe at one time, people describe them as, well, that's a genuine disciple who then lost what they had. They lost the salvation that they had. Problem is, that's not the way Jesus describes it. He describes a problem in the heart from the beginning. It wasn't observed, though. Like the bedrock, it was not observed. It was under there, but nobody would have known that it was under there. The only way that they knew is when the person left. That's what revealed that they did not have that root system, that they did not have actual genuine faith. It could be very difficult to tell the difference between the two. The defect only is seen when the person abandons the faith. That's when you know the character of their heart, that they didn't have a truly receptive heart. What they need is what Deuteronomy 36 calls a circumcision of the heart. They need their stony heart removed and that heart of flesh given to them by God, like Ezekiel, like I read this morning, Ezekiel 36, 26. Jesus took what Ezekiel taught there in chapter 36, and he described that same idea as being born again when he talked to Nicodemus. That's what the person need. They believed in after a sort, but not in a saving way. They weren't born again, and so it wasn't true faith. Now again, how do we know that it's not true faith? The only way that we know is when we observe their leaving. You cannot discern the difference before that time. Externally, the person's going to give off every indication that they are just like you. But the heart of the matter is revealed when they leave, when they abandon the faith. So some reject the gospel without understanding its truth. Others accept it at first, but then later they apostatize, they leave the faith, because their understanding was shallow. The third response that Jesus mentions is hypocrisy. It looks like a true understanding. And this person remains. But it's a false understanding of the gospel. So that third soil is the one that was sown with the thorns. So the condition of the soil is not good. The condition's still not what's necessary for the seed to produce fruit. It's defective. And this time, it has to do with competing loyalties. And it's at this point, we've heard a lot from Jesus about priorities. We've heard that Jesus has to come first. He's very clear about that. And if Jesus doesn't come first, what he's very clear about is that you're not his disciple, no matter what you profess. If you claim to be a disciple, but you do not put him first, you're not worthy of him, he says. So you're not a genuine disciple simply because you profess to believe. And Jesus mentions these two things here, worry and wealth. He mentions those together also in the Sermon on the Mount. And that section concludes with this in verse 33 of chapter 6, but seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things will be added to you. Jesus and his kingdom comes first. So that's the necessity that we need to understand in looking at this. The person here, they receive the good news. They accept the good news about Jesus. They tell you, I believe that message. but they're preoccupied with the concerns of the world or the pursuit of wealth. That person is not going to really do the will of the Father. Not in a genuine way. They're not going to do the kind of good works that are proof of genuine faith. They talk the talk, but they do not walk the walk. They have loyalties that are greater than the word. And so that those loyalties, those other loyalties, those other commitments, those other things that they're focused on, they choke the message of the word so that the message can't have its full effect on the person. It's not enough just to say, yes, that message is true. I believe the good news. For it to have its full effect on a person, it's demonstrated by loyalties that are really genuinely committed to Jesus, to him first. So this is like that stalk of wheat that does not have fruit. It's just a piece of grass at that point. It does not have the obedience that proves the person is a genuine disciple. But again, this is where it gets really hard for us, because these people are in the church. They're remaining in the faith, so to speak. We're seeing them. We see them. We're not fruit inspectors. We don't always see what genuine fruit looks like. We can make mistakes, and so it's difficult to know. But what is it that demonstrates the genuineness of a person's faith? It's not simply their profession. What does Jesus say? At the end of the Sermon on the Mount, as he's making his close, in chapter 7 and verse 19 and 20, he says, "Every tree that does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire. Thus you will recognize them by their fruits." Now, the context is talking about false prophets, but it's the same thing. It's true for any follower of Christ. And then he goes on to say, "Not everyone who says to me, 'Lord, Lord,' will enter the kingdom of heaven, but the one who does the will of my Father who is in heaven." Should sound familiar. It's exactly what Jesus said in the last section, he was dealing with his family. So, Jesus identifies the problem with this person in one word. They're unfruitful. Again, the analogy of on a farm. What happens to the corn stalk in the combining process? It gets shredded up and chucked out the back. All that matters is the kernel of corn. In the analogy, the stock doesn't count. That's not to say that people don't count. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is, in the analogy, how do you demonstrate whether you're a genuine disciple or not? You have to have that ear of corn. You can have signs of life without actually having fruit. And that's what Jesus says is what matters. A fruitless disciple is not a disciple. They were never a disciple. Jesus says this in Matthew 7:23. "I never knew you." He says that to the person who shows up and says, "Lord, Lord," but they don't have any evidence. They don't have any fruit. He doesn't say, "Well, you knew me at one point and then you didn't know me later." He says, "I never knew you. You made a profession. You were in the church. But you weren't truly my disciple." That's what is said, because there wasn't fruit. The sad reality, and really I would say the scary reality, is that hypocrisy most often goes unnoticed by the hypocrite themselves. They're in the church and they assume they're okay, that there's no problem. They would think that they've embraced the gospel in a genuine way. But understand that the gospel is costly. Our salvation is not costly. It's free. Jesus provided for our salvation. But understand that a person who truly believes that, the life that they live is extremely costly. It costs them everything. If you hold on to your life and say, "I'd like Jesus, but I want my life," Jesus says you lose your life in the end. To be his follower, you must give up that life for him. That's not what saves you. It's only Christ that saves you. But a person who does not give up their life, who says, I just want your gift, I'd like to just keep my life," that is not the person who is a genuine disciple. So look at your life. Look at our lives. We should think about, are our lives consumed by the stuff of this life? Is our focus and what comes first in our life, is it paying the bills, keeping up with our home, our car, maintaining our job? Is that what actually is our priority? Is that what matters most to us? Those are the things that choke out the effects of the gospel on a person's life, so that it does not bear fruit, so that it isn't genuine faith. Now, we should be responsible. We should address those things. We should provide for ourselves and do our jobs well. And there are times that genuine disciples get worried about those things. But that's not the same thing as those things becoming the priority in the person's life. So when a difficult thing happens, the true disciple can worry about, well, how am I going to provide? And maybe there's this slightly unethical thing that you can do to kind of provide for yourself. A genuine believer recognizes that the Father is going to provide for me, and I'm going to listen to him and trust him. That's where the level of your priorities are tested. If your priority is taking care of yourself, that's when you stop listening to Jesus. Is that the case? So what about wealth? Jesus notes that wealth is deceitful. It lures you away from Christ. It does this thing where you think that your security is bound up with wealth. So that's why many people pursue it. I want to make sure that I'm secure. I want to make sure that I'm taken care of. And what happens is you're now depending on wealth and your own provision. It's deceptive because wealth isn't actually a security. There's so many things that can happen that can take away what you've provided for yourself. The biggest thing being death. Wealth is not a security. And it also, it presents this idea that it's going to provide the satisfaction you're longing for, the fulfillment that you're longing for. It doesn't provide the fulfillment that you were created for. So it's deceptive. It draws you away. It keeps you from hearing the gospel in an actual true understanding. With true understanding. So focusing on this life, whether it's just trying to meet your needs or whether it's pursuing wealth, focusing on this life will keep you from genuine faith. What is a true disciple? At this point, I think you look at the message of Jesus and you could think, well, is Jesus teaching that becoming a disciple is really a process? It's really a process of learning how to follow Jesus and do what he says. You know, is that what becoming a disciple is? No. Becoming a disciple is not a matter of figuring out how to obey Jesus. Becoming a disciple happens the way Jesus says it happens, by repentance and faith alone. And we should be very careful not to mix that with our obedience. There is a very dangerous effect that happens in Christian thinking when we mingle obedience with our salvation. It's the same Judaizing tendency that plagued the early church, and it's found in a lot of false expressions of the gospel today. Your obedience does not save you in any way, shape, or form. Christ and Christ alone is what saves you, and it is a very dangerous thing to confuse that. You should not trust in yourself in any way. You should depend on Christ and Christ alone. That's important for us to understand. The fruit is not what saves. The fruit is the natural result of salvation. It's the natural result of two things that we see in this fourth response. So those who are disciples, or those who are not disciples, respond with rejection, with apostasy, with hypocrisy. A true disciple responds with action. With action that demonstrates a true understanding of the gospel. So the last soil is the good soil. Jesus describes this person as the one who hears the gospel and they truly understand. This is the first time he says the person understands. They truly understand. How do they truly understand? They do because they actually live out the effects of the gospel. The first person had no saving understanding. The second had a shallow understanding that didn't go deep enough. The third had a false understanding. It looked real, but there wasn't anything to it. Only the final person here understands the gospel. And what is the proof of that? Fruit. The fruit here in this story, it's a natural It's the natural result of two things, good soil and a seed. Under the right conditions, a seed is going to produce fruit. And in the story, the seed's the same. In every case, the seed is the same. There's nothing different about the seed. It wasn't like planted in a certain particular way. The person's scattering the seed. The issue is the soil. That's what Jesus focuses on. The heart is what matters. The heart has been made good, or we could say useful, like the soil, then it's able to receive that seed, and that seed's able to grow. So what a good soil is it's a heart that's been circumcised. According to Deuteronomy, it's a heart that's flesh. It's not a stone heart, like Ezekiel says. It's a person who's been born again. That person receives the word in a saving way. That's what makes the difference. The soil, the inner person. So the Bible teaches that because of the fall, our hearts are deceitful. They're corrupted. They don't function the right way. Our inner person is not working correctly. So Jeremiah says it's deceitful. The Bible describes it as uncircumcised. It describes it as stone. It's not working the right way. But there is a good soil. And the Bible teaches that that good soil is what God produces, not what we produce. So the question, I think, comes naturally off of that is, does that leave us off the hook then? Well, I can't change my heart, so does that mean I'm off the hook? No. We're responsible. It's clear that God needs to create good soil in a person. He needs to change their heart. But on another level, it's equally clear that the people who listen to this message, they're accountable for what they hear. It's not impossible for them to understand. We saw that with Walt Kaiser's professor. You can understand the message. You can understand what's being said. There's no manipulation in the responses. Nobody's being forced to respond the way that they do. They respond the way that they want to. And the Bible teaches that we are responsible for what we think, for what we feel, for what we want. We are responsible for that. There's so much in our world that tries to punt and tell us that we're not actually responsible. Oh, well, this is what happened in my life, and this is what's going on, and I'm not actually responsible. Now, those things are true. There are things that happen, and they impact us, and they affect us, but the Bible's very clear. We are responsible for how we respond. We are responsible for the way that we think. We are responsible. Even if you don't think correctly, you are responsible for the way that you think, for the way that you feel, for the way that you want and desire. We're responsible for that. The Bible does not in any way diminish our responsibility by saying that God needs to come in and make good soil, make good hearts. It's only the person with a renewed heart that responds to the good news, with this true understanding, and demonstrates fruitfulness. And Jesus does add that this fruitfulness varies. So he says that some do 100-fold, some do 60-fold, and some do 30-fold. I say do because that word yields. It's a very ordinary word in Greek. It just means to take action, to do something. When you combine that with fruit, it means to produce results. So the fruit is the outcome of your faith. It's the result of your faith. It flows out of genuine belief. Your behavior flows out of what you believe, what you truly believe. If you truly, genuinely believe in Jesus, then what flows out of that is doing what he says. If you don't do what he says, what that means is you don't really believe. What Jesus says is important to the person who truly believes. And it naturally happens. If you really do believe, then naturally you're going to want to do what he says, and you're going to try to do what he says, and you're going to pursue that. So these good works, they're not what saves you, but they are the very natural result of being saved. As natural as seed that's put in good soil is going to naturally produce some type of yield. So what are we supposed to do? Now, again, I should add, it's not that that means that you must be perfect. And if you're not perfect, then you're not a Christian. But you are going to make progress in following Jesus. You're going to do it penitently because you're not perfect, but you are going to make progress. The person who doesn't make progress, that's the person that should be concerned. What are we supposed to do with this parable? Well, it's important to understand Jesus is not teaching us how to produce good results in our evangelism. Nobody should read this and hear methodology. Now, nobody should. Lots of people do. It's surprising, in fact. In fact, I was reading one book really quickly, and the person says, now, Jesus doesn't say this, but what it's implied here is that he sowed seed at the right timing. And they spent the time to show how this is supposed to connect with their teaching, which has to do with church growth and how you can ensure that you can grow your church quickly. And they use this analogy, and then they just basically skip everything in the illustration, and they say, Jesus is talking about the timing. You need to do it the right timing. What? But at any rate, you should not come to those conclusions. Jesus isn't telling us how to make sure that we sow on good soil. If he were, he'd be being a hypocrite because he didn't do that. Jesus sowed on all these different soils. He had all four different effects. He's not telling us how to avoid the other three. He's telling us why they happen. So don't view this as a way of methodology. What Jesus is doing, though, is he's encouraging his disciples to spread the word, to sow the seed, to share the good news, because there are some who are going to believe. There is good soil out there. So don't be discouraged when you see these other effects. Here's why. They happen. They happen because the hearts are not right. So that they don't respond the way that they should. But there are hearts who have been prepared by God. They are going to receive that good news. So go spread the good news. Expect these different responses. But this is encouragement to actually share the good news, because we can be certain that it's going to have an effect. We shouldn't be surprised when it's rejected. We shouldn't be surprised when even well-known celebrities walk away from the faith. They were the soil on the bedrock. You couldn't see it until they walked away. That should not scandalize us. Jesus said that's what's going to happen. You shouldn't be surprised by these things. We should recognize that this is what happens, and we should call people to become disciples, to turn from their sin, to trust in Jesus, to follow him. So which example are you? Have you heard this message about this king who he arrived into his realm? And the people in his realm, they were rebelling against him. And this king, he could have remained in his royal habitat there. He could have remained there and required the honor that was due him. But he gave up that honor and joined that people, the rebellious people. And he lived with perfect loyalty to the king. But then he took on the punishment that was coming on those rebellious citizens. He took on that. He took the punishment in their place. He could have punished them. He was in that role. He was the king. He's in charge. But he came and he didn't punish sinners. Instead, he came and he lived the way that they were supposed to live. And then he took the punishment that they deserved. But he is coming back. That same king who died on a cross 2,000 years ago, he didn't stay dead. He rose again. And he said he's coming back. And then he will punish the sinners. But he hasn't come back yet. He's given us time to respond to that good news. So he's given us time to turn from our sin, to trust in him. What are you going to do with that message? Are you going to receive it or reject it? Are you going to accept it and then later walk away from it? Are you going to endure? Are you going to say that you believe but then prove unfruitful? Or are you going to bear fruit doing what Jesus, your Lord and Savior, calls you to do? There's only one right response to the good news out of these four. It's the one who understands the good news, receiving that it's true, enduring to the end, and who bears fruit, who listens to what Jesus says, and makes that their priority. They live a changed life following Jesus. So is that you? Join me in prayer. Father, these passages can be very intimidating. I think they're intimidating often because I'm used to hearing something different. I'm used to hearing that all I need to do is something very simple. Pray a prayer. Say that I believe. And like a magic potion, it seems to promise that I'm going to be okay in the end. And it's unnerving to hear the truth. We realize that true belief is not just saying something, doing something at one point in our lives. But it's only found in those that continue on throughout. Father, I pray that you would help us to hear that. And those that know you, Father, those that are pursuing the Father's will, that they would not be scandalized by the truth, that it would be encouraging to them. I'd be encouraged to keep going, encouraged to not lose heart, encouraged to keep sharing the good news with others, even people that have rejected it in the past. Pray, Father, that you would encourage us. Encourage us by this parable. But those, Father, that are any of the other three responses, pray that you'd awaken them to that. You would open their eyes, that they would see the truth of their state. They would respond before it's too late. We ask these things in your Son's name. Amen.